Many millennials are fired up in the wake of a polarizing election. We've seen record-breaking protest marches, contentious town hall meetings, the youthful backing of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. But do young people care for the rough and tumble that is running for office? The intense fundraising, the negative advertising, the accusations of their lack of experience. Hi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for Kathleen Dunn. Our guest this hour has interviewed thousands of high school and college students to get a read on their political ambition. Jennifer Lawless joins us now. She's co-author of several books, including Running From Office, Why Young Americans Are Turned Off to Politics. And she's a professor in the School of Public Affairs at American University. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with President Obama's farewell speech, because there were overtures in his address from Chicago about taking action, making change, and he used some words to describe young people: unselfish, altruistic, creative, and patriotic. Let's listen for a moment.
If something needs fixing, then lace up your shoes and do some organizing. If you're disappointed by your elected officials, grab a clipboard, get some signatures, and run for office yourself.
Do you see this call to action going anywhere? Does it square with your findings?
Well, the good news is that part of the reason young people are turned off to politics and don't even think about running for office is because they are not very likely to receive that encouragement or that suggestion. So the fact that Barack Obama encouraged the next generation to throw their own hats into the ring is something that we're not accustomed to seeing. The bad news is that among high school and college students, almost 90% have already decided that this is something that they would never do because of the rough and tumble, because of how negative and dysfunctional Washington looks. And that was only exacerbated by the 2016 campaign. So we'll see whether the glass is half full or half empty, but I worry that Barack Obama's broad message is not going to be enough to counter years and years of exposure to dysfunction and disillusionment.
Well, big picture here, what are the stakes? Why does it matter that so many young people so early on in their lives are writing off politics?
There are two reasons that it's really important. The first is, and most people don't realize this, we have more than 500,000 elected positions in this country. So what that ultimately means is that roughly one out of every 475 adults is expected to hold some sort of political office. If the best and the brightest and the next generation are not interested in throwing their own hats into the ring and seeking those positions, they won't be vacant. They'll just be occupied by people that are going to perpetuate more of the same, which is what has turned a lot of people off to the political system in the first place. The second reason that it's so important to talk to high school and college students is because the kinds of career options that you see as available to you when you're even 16 years old map pretty well onto how you ultimately pursue a career later in life. And so if you have already written off the idea of becoming a doctor, a lawyer, a politician, or an astronaut when you're in your teens or early college years, it's very, very unlikely that anything will overcome that initial upset, and it's almost, you know, zero probability that you'll ultimately emerge as a candidate.
And you surveyed thousands of these young people, more than 4,000. You also did some pretty in-depth interviews. What were these young people telling you in particular about politics? What was their aversion?
Right. So that's right. So in the fall of 2012, during the Romney Obama campaign, Richard Fox and I did a national survey of about 4,200 high school and college students, and then we did in-depth phone interviews with a random sample of more than 100 of them. And throughout the course of the interviews, and certainly throughout the survey responses, what we saw was a really heightened level of disgust and an attitude of being turned off to what they see in the federal government. They thought that politicians were more self-interested than interested in helping their constituents. They thought that the people that run for office are liars and cheaters, not selfless people who are interested in solving public policy problems. They thought that the system itself rewarded bad behavior. And they also felt that a much more effective, efficient route to bring about change was to work behind the scenes or through an NGO or by staging an economic boycott or working in some way that's not specifically linked to electoral politics. So these young people are interested in making the world a better place. They're interested in investing in their communities. They just don't think of running for and serving in office as an effective way to do that.
And so they're looking for these workarounds, as you mentioned, non-governmental organizations being one of them, looking perhaps for a public service career that is not in one of these, you know, 500,000 elected offices. Besides, as we talked about, the rough and tumble and negativity of politics, the ugliness of politics, are there other indicators out there that are causing millennials to pause and to say, you know, this is not the direction I want to go in? Is there some instability, perhaps, in politics?
It could be that, but another factor that plays a real role here is that the people who are well situated to encourage them to get involved are also very turned off to politics. So we know, for example, that whether your parents encourage you to run for office as a child, whether your teachers or your professors encourage you to think about getting involved in politics when you're in high school or college, whether your bosses or mentors or clergy suggest that you throw your hat into the ring are all very good predictors of at least planting the seed of a future candidacy. We also know that at this point in time, congressional approval is at an all-time low. The federal government is trusted by only about a single digit of Americans. Most people, when they're polled, believe that every other political institution is more effective and more efficient than the United States Congress. And so the adults that are well situated to encourage young people to run for office look around and think, why would I tell the best and the brightest out there to get involved in politics? It's totally dysfunctional. There are so many other ways that they could be affected. So what we wind up seeing is a cycle where adults are not encouraging young people to get involved because they're turned off. And then that lack of exposure and that lack of encouragement reinforces young people's sentiment that the political system is not effective in the first place.
We're talking with Jennifer Lawless. She is a professor in the Department of Government at American University in Washington. Her research focuses on political ambition, and she's the co-author of several books on that theme, including Women on the Run, Gender, Media, and Political Campaigns in a Polarized Era, and Running from Office, Why Young Americans Are Turned Off to Politics. Jennifer, what about previous generations, such as baby boomers, the silent generation, have they had similar repulsions to running for political office?
That's the big question. And the answer, quite frankly, is we don't know, but we don't think so. And let me just elaborate for a minute. As far as we know, this is the first national study of young people's attitudes toward running for office. So it's not like we can compare these results to Generation X or the baby boomers or the silent generation. We do know, though, that the kinds of things that predict whether a young person is interested in running for office, like whether their parents have suggested it or they talk about politics at home, whether they take political science classes at school, whether they participate in student government, whether they trust the political system, we know that all of those predictors have changed over time and they've gone in the negative direction. So what this means is that the Generation Xers, the baby boomers, and the silent generation are more likely to have the key ingredients that facilitate interest in running for office than millennials do.
And there's an outlier here in 26-year-old recently elected mayor of Stockton, California. That is Michael Tubbs. His dream was to return to his hometown, serve in elected office. And we've pulled a clip of him giving a TEDx talk in 2013 at his alma mater, Stanford University. And he thought what was holding him back was surprisingly his pedigree. Let's take a listen.
I said, okay, Michael, why did you want this fellowship? Because you don't really like school that much, so you did not want to get a doctor of philosophy. So what did you want this fellowship for? And I said, I wanted the fellowship because I want to go back to Stockton and serve my community. I need a doctor of philosophy from Oxford to do that. And then... but then being a Stanfordson that I am, I Googled. And I Googled, what does it take to be an elected official? And I found something maybe you guys didn't know. It only requires 50% plus winning the vote and being 18.
Can you react to what he was saying there, feeling like he needed further education and a standout doctor of philosophy to even go after a political position?
It's interesting that he made those comments because they're not rare, except rarely do we hear men say those things. So one of the most interesting findings in the book, and we've also seen this among adults, is that women are far more likely than men to doubt that they're qualified to run for office. And so we hear women and young girls even say that, well, they could never run for office because even when they graduate from college, they're not going to have the appropriate degrees, they're not going to have the political connections, they're not the best public speaker, they're not going to have the most money. And as a result, they don't even really consider a candidacy. Whereas the men and the young men that we spoke to said things like, well, as long as they had passion and vision, they would be well qualified to run for office. So I think the sentiment conveyed in that clip is exactly right. It's just, and it's true for both women and men, you don't need all of those degrees. You really just need the passion, the vision, and the ability to win the election. But usually those kinds of sentiments are expressed more by women than men.
And let's unpack a little bit here the 10 or 11% of people, of these young people who said they haven't ruled out a run for office. Who are these young people in the minority? And, did you see any things in common with what they were saying?
We did. The big commonality across these people was that they're already very, very politically interested and politically aware. And it was somewhat of a surprise to us because what we found in general was that young people, when they were exposed to politics, generally tried to run away from it because they didn't like it. So they didn't want to talk to about politics with their friends because they thought that it would lead to an argument. They didn't talk about politics with their families because they didn't want to ultimately just wind up having conversations about how the government was ineffective. And they didn't want to watch politics on TV because they didn't want to see tons of examples of politicians behaving badly and dysfunction running rampant. But those who were very politically aware, who were exposed to all of those things but at heightened levels, were actually the most likely to be interested because in having these conversations with their friends, in having these conversations with their families, and in watching high levels of news on television, they wound up seeing a lot of examples also of politics working exactly the way that it's supposed to. So they weren't only seeing men behaving badly in Washington, D.C. They were also seeing legislators across the country getting the job done. They weren't only hearing about the problems that elected officials couldn't fix. They were also hearing about those that could be fixed. And so heightened exposure actually increases the likelihood that you'll see politics working in a positive way. It's just that you have to wade through a lot of muck and endure quite a bit to gain that kind of heightened exposure.
Did you see any sense of legacy, meaning legacy families where a parent was holding a political office, an elected position, and the child saw that parent each and every day perhaps ascend to that role and then found themselves going down the same path as that parent? I'm also thinking of the Kennedy family, for instance.
Right. We did not, but part of the reason was we just didn't have a lot of people in the sample whose parents had ever run for office.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that if you look at the United States Congress, for example, there are roughly 24 members whose parents had served. There's nothing short of a clear link there. Nancy Pelosi, for example, has told the story about how her father was the mayor of Baltimore. Her brother was involved in politics. There was no question, of course, she would be involved. Beau Biden, who had been attorney general in Delaware, said that, having dinner with his father, Joe Biden, throughout his life made it clear that the expectation was that, of course, he would one day run for office. But your parents don't have to actually be in politics. Just having those regular conversations about politics with them does a lot to spur the interest because it places a heightened premium on civic engagement and the duty involved in serving your country through electoral means. It's just that most families aren't having those conversations.
We're talking with American University political science professor Jennifer Lawless about the future of American politics and the lack of millennials and the lack of women who are pursuing candidacies for elected office. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Are you concerned that young people are turned off by politics? Are you a millennial, perhaps, and you hold elected office? What got you into politics? Join in this discussion at 800-642-1234 or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll be back after a short break here on the Ideas Network. Good afternoon. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn. We're exploring this hour what keeps young people and women from running for office. There are more than 1,800 women serving in state legislative bodies across the nation this year. But women candidates fail to win even a quarter of the nation's legislative seats. They make up more than half the electorate. Join in the discussion right now at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We're continuing our conversation with American University political science professor Jennifer Lawless, who has long studied these trends in who holds elected offices. Jennifer, what about women? What is holding women back from running for elected office?
The two biggest barriers keeping women from throwing their own hats into the ring have to do with external and internal factors. So externally, what we've found is that women who exist in the same tier of professional accomplishments as men, the top tier of law, business, education, or political activism, are not equally likely to receive the suggestion to run from party leaders, elected officials, political activists, or even their colleagues, family members, or friends. When women receive the suggestion to run, they're just as likely as men to respond positively to it. But even when they're operating in these political circles, they're less likely than men to get that external encouragement.
Let's take a call now. Charlie from Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was going to ask your guest, how important is the consistency of the policy so that people can really, adopt and can keep consistent certain beliefs in the political spectrum through their whole career? I'm thinking specifically about the Merrick Garland nomination, where 10, 15 years ago, Democrats said one thing and the Republicans said another, and then 15 years later, it's the exact opposite. Are people concerned about the lack of quote-unquote honesty and being consistent with the certain policies that they want to adopt as they take on a political career? Thanks very much.
Jennifer?
Something that certainly came up over and over again in the interviews was the sense that politicians, especially when they're running for office, will say anything that it takes to get elected. And it doesn't matter if that's consistent with what they've previously said. It doesn't matter if it's consistent with what they'll ultimately do. And what we found was young people saying over and over again that it wasn't that they were flip-flopping on policy preferences. It was that they were just explicitly lying or misleading the public because they wanted raw power. And these young people said, look, I am not like that. I have no interest in being like that. If I get involved, I want to get involved and sort of stay true to my convictions, and that's why I don't think electoral politics is the way to do it. Now, the irony, of course, is that the overwhelming majority of elected officials don't behave that way. And in fact, we've seen over the course of the last 20 years, party loyalty scores go through the roof, where Democrats are now far more likely to always vote the Democratic side, and Republicans are almost always likely to vote with Republicans. But none of that really matters. What we see are high-profile examples of flip-flopping or high-profile examples of dysfunction or high-profile, you know, with disasters like the government shutdown in the fall of 2013, and that sort of colors our view of what all politics must be like, even at the state or local level.
Charlie, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Caleb now in Platteville. Hi, Caleb.
Hello, yes. So I graduated this last May with a degree in political science and a minor in social media. I held office both in high school and in college in the student body. My last position I represented the student body to Congress was my favorite job. And I've also worked in campaigns. And within my friends and family, I've always played kind of like a moderator role. I'm like Anderson Cooper at the debate type of thing, and always tried to help people find a middle ground, and I've always thought about running for office. However, I feel like there's no room for that role anymore. Everyone is just so black and white, left, white, that there's no room for any middle, like, whatsoever. So there's no role for me in politics currently. So that's why I'm not running for office, at least anytime soon, and I think it's unfortunate.
I think that that's not particularly uncommon. The most important thing, though, is that, you know, the caller had run for office as a student. And that's one of the biggest predictors of running for office later in life. So when we ask young people, is this something that you would consider doing, we're not necessarily saying, is this something that you would consider doing tomorrow or next month or next year? But if the seed has been planted and if the idea is at least something that has occurred to them, then it's much more likely, even 20 or 30 years down the road, that it's something that will actually happen. So, you know, it's important to get young people involved. And even if there's a lapse between serving in student government and ultimately serving as an elected official, that's okay. What matters is that the idea is at least percolating.
I've been reading recently about a so-called Trump bump, not in terms of the financial markets, but the Trump presidency pushing more young people, more females in particular, to decide to run. Are you seeing this in real life? Is there data behind this, perhaps a trend?
The only data that we have so far coming out of women's organizations that are reporting record levels of women signing up for candidate training programs. And so that certainly is good news. Whether those numbers translate into a heightened number of candidacies, we'll have to wait and see. We also know that, you know, people take these campaign training programs not necessarily to run for office the next election cycle. So even if we don't see a huge bump in 2018, I certainly don't think that we should assume that we're not going to see numbers trickling up over time. The counter to that, the glass is more empty version, is that one of the reasons women are reluctant to run for office is because they doubt that they're qualified. They think that they would have to be twice as good to get half as far because of rampant sexism in the electoral environment. The reality is that for the overwhelming majority of offices out there, women are just as successful as men when they run for office. They raise just as much money, and their media coverage actually looks the same. But what we saw in the presidential election really puts on display some of the most egregious sexist behavior we've seen in the political environment. And so it's possible, too, that there are women who might otherwise have considered running for office who saw in 2016 the worst of their fears being realized in the electoral arena and wrote that off. So how those two camps fall out, it's a little bit too early to tell.
Let's take another call now. We're going to go to Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom.
I took some classes at American University in Washington, D.C. I'd like to make some quick points. At the going through at the store, going through the counter, they had the Inquirer every week had a horrible picture of Mrs. Clinton on the front page, and evidently the publisher is a friend of Mr. Trump's. But what I wanted to ask was, among the women who voted, they say that the majority of those actually voted for Mr. Millennium women who voted for Mr. Trump. I wonder if that's true and where we can get that information. And the next thing I wanted to ask was, with negative ads, that they just bombard people with the negative ads here in Wisconsin, that turns a lot of people off of voting also. And in Europe, they're not allowed to have negative ads at least for a month before the election. Anyway, I'd like your views.
Well, as far as the first question is concerned, millennials, women and men alike, went overwhelmingly for Clinton. So that is not the case. Now, in the primary, about 80% of millennial men and women actually supported Bernie Sanders over Hillary Clinton, but when it came to the general election, they got on board and voted for Clinton, although their turnout was by no means record level. As far as the campaigns are concerned, negative campaigns are, in fact, part of what we think about when we say that politics is dysfunctional. And something that came up over and over again in these interviews and on the survey was the idea that you have to be mean-spirited, you have to be willing to endure a complete invasion of privacy, you have to be willing to be attacked in a public forum, and that was just not something that was very satisfying or appealing to young people. Of course, the important thing to keep in mind here is, again, with 500,000 elected offices in this country, most offices do not involve these high-profile campaigns or incidents of the media rifling through your trash, right? Most of these are relatively low-budget affairs where you'll get one or two newspaper articles and you're really just campaigning in your own community. But what happens is we look at the presidential election or we look at some very high-profile Senate races, we decide that that's something we are not willing to endure, and then we don't even run for school board.
Tom, thank you so much for your call at 800-642-1234. We're talking with Jennifer Lawless. She is a political science professor at American University. We're discussing her research on millennials who tend to say they don't want to run for political office. She is also closely monitoring the path of women to elected offices. 500,000 elected office positions up for grabs in America. And she has been taking a close look at who is taking those positions, who is running for those positions. Jennifer, let's talk for a moment about the rise of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and young people. Sanders won more votes from those under 30 than any other presidential candidate in primary history. Do you see an interesting plot twist ahead in races for elected office and how millennials embraced Sanders? Is there any correlation?
Well, I think what we saw was millennials embracing something that was anti-establishment. Now, obviously, there was debate, especially among non-millennials, about the extent to which Bernie Sanders actually did or did not represent the establishment. He had served in elected office longer than Clinton had, and he just hadn't been affiliated with the Democratic Party. But I think what we saw was that you don't have to necessarily be the kind of charismatic candidate that Barack Obama was to get young people excited and energized. You just have to represent something that highlights what they think is a problem with the process. And his messaging about economic inequality and the sort of straight shooting kind of rhetoric that he engaged in was effective. And so I think that that could potentially open up more opportunities for people who are thinking about running for office, because we've now seen at least a couple of different examples of candidates that resonate with young people, where most people would not say that Barack Obama and Bernie Sanders have much in common when it comes to their personal style.
Let's take another caller now, John from Algoma. Hi, John.
Hi. I guess where I'm coming from, I don't claim to have any corner on why millennials might or might not run for office, but I have been involved in recruiting candidates for state and national office in rural Wisconsin for over the last 8 years, involved in a community-based approach to bringing candidates to the fore. And your guest has made a whole long list of strong points about why millennials not appear to be interested in running for office. I would say that based on anecdotal evidence, the data show to me that those same reasons are the reasons that other folks in other older generations don't run for office as well. Politics and being a politician is not exactly a desirable role in society today. And people are very, very concerned, particularly in rural places, about the punishment that their families are subjected to when they do run for office. They're likewise intimidated by the enormous amounts of money that it takes to run for office. In the state of Wisconsin, to simply run for an assembly seat, the parties will tell you you need to be able to raise between $125,000 and $150,000. That is extremely intimidating to people who, you know, probably haven't been involved in raising money for anything other than their local PTA in the past.
Well, John, I want to stop you there. So as a candidate recruiter, how do you sell people on the job? I mean, how do you go about encouraging people to run?
By bringing in people who have done or are doing the job, who can talk about the reality of the experience and the value that they find in doing it, and how they deal with those very onerous experiences that we see in the media. Contrary to what some people might suggest, just because you're not covered on the local television station, letters to the editor are very pointed and abusive in rural places. And everybody reads them. So they don't escape public criticism by any means. And they're much more, very much aware of that, and that their children will be subjected to that kind of criticism in school. I mean, it leads to bullying in schools. it leads to abuse. It's a very, very difficult row to hoe, frankly.
And Jennifer, you talked about how invasive politics can be, but what about fundraising, the amount of money that has to be raised and having to ask for that money, to be in it for having to ask and go up to people and say, hey, I need your support. I need your money.
I ran for Congress in 2006, and I can tell you that that's definitely the most unappealing part of the job. But the way that I came to think about it was that, and the way that I speak to people who are thinking about running for office about it, is that in any job and in any position, there are certain things that you like and there are certain things that you hate. And once you realize that that's just the bad piece of it, and the rest of the time you get to talk to constituents and you get to find out why people need help and what they want the government to do, and you can figure out what's going on in your community, all of those things really outweigh the fundraising. But there's no question that it's unappealing. It can be not miserable. It's just, you know, a fact of life at this point, given the way our campaign finance system works. But a piece that I want to add to this is that although I think these are all reasons that adults who would otherwise maybe consider running for office decide not to run, these were really not the main factors that were a problem for the young people. They weren't actually thinking that much about the nuts and the bolts of the campaign. They were thinking more about what the political system represents and what politicians are like. And so they were basically writing off the idea of even considering themselves as candidates and if they would be willing to run for office. They were at the previous stage of that decision-making process writing themselves off as politicians altogether. And so I agree with the caller. You know, I don't dispute anything that he said, but I think that the difference between young people and sort of more fully established adults is that a lot of the things that discourage adults from running for office have to do with campaign mechanics. For the high school and college students, a lot of it had to do with more abstract or amorphous sentiments about the kinds of people who run.
I have to ask, would you consider running again for elected office? It's been, you know, more than a decade.
It has. I mean, there is no question that it was the most important, meaningful experience of my life. And at the time, I always thought that I would run again. Several years after I ran, though, I was asked to consider applying for the job that I have now, which is the director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University. And so Washington, D.C. doesn't, at the federal level anyway, have true representation. So at this point, given my career and where I live, it's not in the cards, but I would certainly not write it off at some point in the future.
We're talking with Jennifer Lawless, a political science professor at American University, about what is keeping millennials away from elected offices and whether a polarizing election will make an impact on this trend line. Her most recent book she co-authored is Women on the Run: Gender, Media, and Political Campaigns in a Polarized Era. And we want to hear from you. Are you a millennial seeking a run for office? What obstacles have you encountered, or what has been less challenging than you anticipated? Tell us about your experience in pursuing elected office at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn today. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. First, we're picking up our conversation with Jennifer Lawless. She directs the Women and Politics Institute at American University. We're discussing what keeps millennials and women on the sidelines of politics. We want to know if this topic hits home for you at 1-800-642-1234. Are you a millennial entering politics? And if so, what's driving you to do it? Or what's holding you back? Join in the discussion at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's now go to Bill in Watertown. Hi, Bill.
Yes, hello. Hello, Ms. Lawless, and thanks for the show. I'll make a couple of quick comments. I think the political process has been bastardized. We don't recognize what it should be, the ideal of it. I spent about the last 7 years trying to come up with a model to make it easy, enjoyable, and effective for massive numbers of citizens in their communities to partake in their political process. The word itself comes from the Greek route for citizenship to be involved in your community. And I think when we focus on just electoral campaigns and just issue campaigns, and we don't develop any models to promote ways for citizenships and citizens in each community to participate, that we look at it in the wrong way. And I think we need to look at it as a way to create a Peace Corps for democracy. And Paul Wellstone wanted these permanent, independent, progressive grassroots groups in each community. Noam Chomsky talks about the need to avoid just believing that it's our responsibility solely to vote or to maybe help in a campaign. We don't look at civics anymore. President Obama talked about it. Are you aware of any other models, and I am not, that look at this elephant in the room and get back to the basics to try to make it easy, enjoyable, and effective for large groups of citizens to work together? As I say, I've created such a model. I'm not aware of anyone else that has, so thank you.
I think I'm familiar with a series of different programs in some states that are encouraging young people to get involved and have conversations about politics and to sort of promote civic engagement. Generation Citizen is one of them. The issue basically is that all of these attempts are quite piecemeal. And so even the organizations that are doing great work are limited in that it's difficult to be all over the country. And it's also difficult, especially in these political times, to do this in a nonpartisan or bipartisan way. I mean, what I always think about is the Peace Corps or AmeriCorps or Teach for America. We haven't seen any kind of similar program run out of Washington to encourage elected office. We've seen an emphasis on volunteerism. We've seen an interest in education. But in terms of running for office, we haven't seen that. I think the last administration was probably more likely than the current one to place a priority on that issue, and it still didn't rise to the occasion.
Bill, thanks so much for your call. Let's go now to Emily in Madison. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
What would you like to add?
I just wanted to say that as a millennial, I find it very difficult to earn enough money to live and have a social life and pay my rent and eat dinner, much less, like, after that I'm so exhausted. I have no time to even think about running for office. And that's something I've always been very active in politics in school. I love politics, but, you know, there's just no guarantee that I would be compensated during my campaign, and that's a huge commitment. I don't have the time or the energy after working so much.
What advice would you give her, Jennifer?
Unfortunately, that's the case for a lot of people, but it's also nothing new. So these are trade-offs that generation upon generation have had to come to terms with. I think part of the reason that for millennials, politics is falling by the wayside is because they've grown up and been socialized amid a political environment where all they've known is hyper-partisanship and polarization and dysfunction. For most of them, their first political memory is either Bill Clinton lying about Monica Lewinsky or George Bush lying about weapons of mass destruction. Two of the last five elections that they've been eligible to vote in saw electoral college and popular vote totals go in the opposite direction. There's just a lot that makes it kind of easy to say, well, if I have to choose one or the other, it's easy for me not to choose politics. But that's not a new concern. For us in the United States, politics and running for office has always been sort of a hobby or a side career. The question is just who has an incentive to prioritize it.
Jennifer, there are a number of organizations out there that are in the trenches, encouraging young people and women especially to run for office, and they have these very specific programs and a lot of support material out there. Are these types of organizations helpful? Are they making progress?
They're certainly helpful. So one of the most effective ones, I think, is Emerge America. Full disclosure, I'm on the National Advisory Board for that organization, but they provide training for women who are interested in running for office, whether it be at the state, local, or federal level. They're in 15 different states, so the training programs take into account the local political environment, and they've translated interest in running for office, the people that take their training programs, more than two-thirds of their trainees actually run, and well over half of them win. So it's very feasible once you have the people in the room to convince women to run for office and to give them the skills required to do so. Emily's List is incredibly successful identifying competitive races and making sure that women have the training and the resources necessary to win those contests, especially at the federal level. But no one organization can do anything. And I think that it would make all of these organizations' lives a lot easier and their work less challenging if we just started putting more of a premium on talking about politics and encouraging the next generation to at least consider it.
Emily, thanks so much for calling in. Let's go to Adam now from Miquon. Hi, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to add?
Well, I was just talking to your screener about my daughter. She's 10 years old, and I've always, you know, kind of encouraged her to, serve in public office, or, you know, serve the public, basically, serve our community. But I'm not politically involved, just a sideline, you know, viewer. But I would like my daughter to be part of the community that you know is politics, but I have no clue where to start, how to encourage her, or as far as I can tell, you know, I've told her that she needs to study law, and that would be a path to getting to that end game or end goal. So I'm just looking for, you know, answers or, you know, direction, a little bit of help on identifying, things that I can do at this time. I know she's only 10 years old, but, you know, in 8 short years, she'll be going off to college, and I'd like to, help direct some of it.
Jennifer, what should we tell our young kids?
Well, I mean, I think that's great. And a couple of things that are pretty easy to do is, first, make sure you take her with you when you go to vote, because that just instills from a very, very early age the importance of civic duty and engagement. The other thing I would say is encourage her to run for student government. Even elementary and junior high schools have elections, and teaching young women and men and girls and boys that competing is a good thing and losing is fine too is one of the most important lessons that we can teach to prepare young people to ultimately go into politics. And the other thing that I would note is volunteering in the community around an issue that matters to you and your daughter would be a good way to get involved too, and to meet people who are probably politically engaged and might have more ideas on their own. So I would say take her to vote, get her to run for student government, and maybe identify an issue or a topic in the community where there's an opportunity to volunteer and do that together.
Adam, thanks so much for that call. Along Adam's thread, what can be done to help fix the problem? Have you looked at potential fixes to get more millennials, to get more women into elected positions from all parts of the political spectrum?
Well, the easiest fix, actually, is something that we and every listener can do today, which is to encourage especially women to think about running for office. When a woman is encouraged to run, whether it be by a formal electoral gatekeeper or even a family member or a friend, she's much more likely to at least give it thought. That doesn't mean she'll necessarily do it, but it at least gets it on her radar screen. And that's one of the biggest impediments, that women are less likely to even have it occur to them in the first place that running for office is a viable path for the future. The other thing I would say is that it's really important to debunk the myths about what happens when women run for office. Again, because there are these high-profile examples of sexism and discrimination in politics, we tend to think that women have a tougher road to hoe, and that it's going to be, you know, rife with sexism, discrimination, and gender bias, when the reality is that in both primaries and general elections, women on both sides of the aisle perform just as well as men. that they raise just as much money and that they're generally treated by the local media anyway in the same way. And so if we can begin to debunk myths and sort of put in perspective some of these high-profile, egregious examples of sexism and recognize that part of the reason they're so high-profile is because they're unusual, I think that would go a long way in starting to quell women's doubts about whether they have what it takes.
And Adam mentioned encouraging his young daughter to pursue a law degree, to pursue law, which is one channel into government and politics. We just saw in the President Trump's ascent to the Oval Office, not that path, an unconventional, perhaps, path to leadership. What does that tell these young people about rising in political office, that there perhaps is more than one way?
I think it does suggest that there's more than one way. My concern for women in particular, though, is that it could send the signal that a man with no political experience whatsoever defeated a woman who objectively probably had more qualifications and credentials than any political presidential candidate we've seen in modern history. So, you know, it's good news that you don't necessarily have to have a certain background in order to be successful in politics. It's bad news when the person who is the spokesperson for that view defeated a woman who was clearly very well qualified.
Adam, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Dave now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Dave.
Hello. My thought is that I've seen the quality of politicians going down ever since Reagan famously said the government is not part of the problem, the government is the problem. This discourages people from, qualified people, from running for office. And I guess that's about it.
I think that's part of it. We especially saw that kids with Republican parents were particularly unlikely to say that they were interested in running for office because of the sense that government is the problem and that it should be made smaller and that it's not important to fill up all of these elected positions. We should actually get rid of these elected positions. Democrats, on the other hand, were a little bit more likely not only to subscribe to the value of government but also to encourage their children to seek those positions. Even among Democrats, though, levels of interest were quite low.
Dave, thanks so much for your call. Gigi on Facebook says, my son interned both in the assembly and for a congressman, but he realized he would mostly be fundraising, and therefore he got into tech. What portion of time is devoted to fundraising, Jennifer?
It depends on the level of office. You know, when I ran for Congress, we were spending probably about 35 hours a week fundraising, which is awful. But
that's a lot.
It's definitely a lot. I mean, the issue is, you know, the average congressional race now costs about $1.5 million. And so in order to run the kind of campaign that you need to run, if you're not independently wealthy, I certainly was not, you have to spend that time dialing for dollars. And, you know, the reality is, as much as I didn't want to believe it, that when you're asking people to give a lot of money, they want to talk to the candidate. They don't want to talk to some volunteer on behalf of the candidate. It's different at the presidential level, but generally, most of the time, the candidate is the most effective person to raise the money. But when you go to local-level offices or even state-level offices, there's a lot more variation. I mean, there are some state legislatures across the country where the average race costs only about $7,000 or $8,000. There are some local contests, especially for you know, positions that go pretty uncontested, positions that many people have never even heard of, where just a few hundred dollars is all that's really required in a campaign. And so it's true, especially if you get a high-profile internship for a Senate candidate or a House candidate, that you might spend a lot of time doing fundraising, that as you sort of go down that ladder, the total amount of money needed to run a credible campaign decreases, and thus so does the amount of time spent raising it.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Jennifer Lawless is a political science professor at American University. She's co-author of several books, including Running from Office: Why Young Americans Are Turned Off to Politics. We can continue this discussion on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow at this time, has the emergence of the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party demonstrated that there is a growing appeal to some form of socialism? We'll discuss the rise and fall of the Socialist Party, which has deep historical roots, by the way, in Wisconsin, particularly Milwaukee. Look at why it's now considered a dirty word in American politics and why maybe making a kind of comeback. Hope you can join us. And stay with us after the news as we hear a very personal story from journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones about her family's agonizing decision to enroll her daughter in a hyper-segregated public school. Thanks to producer Scotty Myers with on-air production help from Jason Butler and technical direction today from Dave Potraz. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network.